next proceeding, file A18-1310, Julian Sanchez, petitioner appellant in this matter versus State of Minnesota, respondent. And as counsel's familiar, each be allowed 15 minutes with a 5-minute response. And please remember to identify yourself for the record. And counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Zach Longstorff, and I represent the appellant Julian Sanchez. This appeal stems from the denial of Mr. Sanchez's request for resentencing using the Drug Sentencing Reform Act of 2016 Drug Offender Sentencing Grid by the Hennepin County District Court in June of 2018. The most important issue before the court today from my client's perspective is whether the district court erred in concluding that he didn't need to be resentenced under Kirby. And I think that understanding a little bit about where this case came from is helpful in understanding why this is such an important issue. So what happened was, on direct appeal in this case, the Minnesota Supreme Court took the case to determine whether the rules of evidence would apply at a sentencing trial that was tried to the district court instead of a jury. The Supreme Court decided that, yes, in fact, the rules of evidence would apply, but Mr. Sanchez didn't get relief because no objection had been made at his sentencing hearing, and the court was applying the clear error test. So it determined that the clear error prong of the three prongs of the clear error test couldn't be satisfied, and he didn't get relief. What happened after that then was that on May 23rd of 2016, the new grid in the Drug Sentencing Reform Act took effect, and about a year after that, the Minnesota Supreme Court decided Kirby, where it vacated the sentence and remanded for resentencing.
But Kirby was not a case involving an upward departure.
Correct. No, Kirby was just a straight sentence, and I'll address that too. But I just want to finish this thought while I'm on it. And what happens when the Supreme Court looks at a case as being vacated is they've said, and we cited these cases in our reply brief. They look at it essentially like the sentencing is coming up anew. And our position would be that if Mr. Sanchez was entitled to be resentenced because he triggered all three Kirby factors, then at that sentencing he would have the opportunity to object, and in particular object to the use of these aggravating factors that were proved by the testimony of just one witness who was a law enforcement officer who funneled kind of to the court what something like 13 different co-defendants said, what alleged drug notes said, what forensic accountants had told him. And so our position is that if he should have been resentenced under Kirby, then he would have had an opportunity to object to that, and we believe that Kirby does require that he be resentenced. And there's three prongs to Kirby, and the only one I think that's really at issue in here is whether this mitigates the punishment for Mr. Sanchez, because the first one is whether the legislature intended to abrogate the amelioration doctrine, and the third is the timing, and the middle is mitigation. And I think that Kirby's probably dispositive on that question for this case, because it was a first-degree controlled substance case in Kirby, and this is also a first-degree controlled substance case. And also the Supreme Court in Kirby talked about the new grid overall mitigating or trending toward mitigation when discussing it. And also I think the facts apply here, that when figuring out what Mr. Sanchez's sentence should have been, we went from zero criminal history scores up to a severity level, and he had the range of 74 to 103 with the presumptive of 86. And under the new guideline, it went from 56 to 78 with a presumptive of 65. And so I think the fact that there's an upward departure in this case isn't really any reason to say Kirby doesn't apply, particularly because a panel of this court in the case Mangum, it's either Magnum or Mangum, I think it's pronounced Mangum, dealt with a downward departure and still said that all of the Kirby factors were ticked off. And I don't see any reason why it would be different if, in fact, it were an upward departure. And I think really what we look at in Mangum is a good example of that. is it's a two-part process. First, we see if Kirby's satisfied, and if that's the case, then you move on to sentencing and decide if the sentence is appropriate, what it should be, along with all the things that come along with that, including whether you can aggravate the sentence or not aggravate it. And I think there's nothing about Kirby in the Supreme Court decision that really gives any indication that it wouldn't apply to an upward departure. And as I think about it, you could, theoretically, a judge could give a sentence within the guideline, apply Kirby and say, well, I picked the number in there because I thought it was good, not because it was in the guideline or not because it was the presumptive. And then if this district court's ruling is what we adopt as the standard, then that would keep Kirby from applying even if a sentence was within the guidelines. And I don't think that that's the case. I just think it's a, you look at, to determine Mr. Sanchez's sentence, we went up and then over, we found the box, and that's what his PSI started with, and that's how ultimately he's sentenced, is starting from that point. And so I think that, because that was reduced, I think that it does mitigate the punishment for his particular crime. And then the question is, at sentencing, what's the appropriate way to deal with that?
Can I just clarify, Mr. Longdorf? So Kirby was followed in the sense that the court ordered a resentencing, correct, under the guidelines. The point being, though, the court nevertheless departed. And your point, you agree that Kirby does not preclude, since it wasn't addressed in Kirby, as long as the correct guidelines are now considered to depart, and it just happens to be the same departure, so I understand your point, the excess became a little bit more under the new guideline than the old guideline, but there's nothing in Kirby that would prohibit that.
Well, I don't think the district court actually resentenced Mr. Sanchez, because what happened was he filed the petition for post-conviction relief. We got an order on November 29th. Of 2017. That order says, I agree that the Kirby factors are satisfied, he should be resentenced. But when we showed up for the resentencing hearing, and this is in the transcript from the April hearing, the judge said, I'm not sure that this is a resentencing. And then we went back and forth at that hearing about whether Kirby was even applicable. And ultimately, I think the order concluded that Kirby didn't apply, he doesn't need to be resentenced. And the order says something to the effect that I'm making a note that we looked at the possible change, but we're leaving it the same. So I don't even think he was resentenced. And I think that it really is a distinct question, and Mangum is a good example of it. First, does Kirby apply, yes or no? If so, then we go to sentencing and deal with everything there. And that's what I think that the opinion in Mangum did, was it looked at them separately. So I think, in this case, the district court never got to the point where it resentenced Mr. Sanchez for some reason, and even though it had an order that already said he did, was entitled to be resentenced. The prosecution has argued that these claims about the objection and whether it was appropriate to use the aggravating factors and even the length of the sentence are procedurally barred under these circumstances, but I just don't see that as the purpose of the procedural bars in NAFLA or the statute. Because as I just explained, what happened was we have here a situation where the court issues an order, says he's coming on for resentencing. And in my view, if you have a scenario where the legislature changes the punishment for a crime even after you're already sentenced, and then the Minnesota Supreme Court decides a case and says, yep, if you can tick these three boxes, you should be resentenced. I don't think when you get back to resentencing that the law means that you can't make an objection to the use of what are obviously illegitimately proven aggravating factors or to the length of your sentence. So I don't see there being any procedural problem with that if we get to the point where Mr. Sanchez is actually being resentenced. And the other thing is, I don't know of any case law that says that that's the case, so I think this would, like we talked about in our reply brief, would fall under either a novelty exception or the interest of justice to having that heard on the merits. And really, I think what we're saying here is if Mr. Sanchez was entitled to be resentenced under Kirby, then he should be resentenced and everything that goes along with his sentence, including whether it's proper to depart upward and whether these aggravating factors are sufficient and legitimate, and even the amount of the upward departure should all be at issue. And I don't think those things were really addressed because the district court somehow, even after concluding he should be resentenced, didn't really resentence him. And then finally, I just want to touch on the idea that Mr. Sanchez shouldn't have got a proportionate reduction. I think what happens is we don't have a case that says what happens where there's an upward departure, if a defendant should get a proportional reduction or not, but I think that under the circumstances, that the rule that should come out of that in a case like this is that if there's an upward departure, and then for that specific crime, the legislature says the punishment was too much, and we're going to reduce that going forward, and then the Supreme Court does its analysis and says, yeah, we believe that it applies to you, Mr. Sanchez, or to people in your position, that the defendant should get the benefit of that reduction, at least a proportionate reduction, which in this case I think would put Mr. Sanchez at 181 months. And now I understand that the district court didn't explain that it just picked 240 as what it believed to be the appropriate sentence and not necessarily based on the guidelines. But I just think that the circumstances here where the legislature steps in and says we're going to reduce all these means that if there is an upward departure, the rule should be that the defendant gets the benefit of that when he comes up for resentencing. And I think specifically because in Mangum and in Robbins we talked about either negotiated sentences or negotiated ranges, I think that's particularly true in a case like this where there's no negotiated sentence. This was just a straight plea. When my client was looking at what his possible outcomes are, he's looking at the box in the sentencing guidelines, and ultimately his sentence didn't really correspond to that, but that's what's informing him as he makes his decision about how to operate, whether to enter a guilty plea or not. So we believe that even setting aside the issue of whether those aggravating factors are legitimate or not, that he should get the benefit of that. And absent any questions, I've covered everything I came with.
Very well, thank you, counsel. And counsel for respondent, you may respond.
May it please the court, my name is Linda Fryer. I'm with the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, and I represent the state of Minnesota in this matter. Your Honor, here today, appellate has relied very heavily on Mangan and Robbins, but in both those cases, the reasoning of the Court of Appeals was tied to the fact that, as the court said at Mangan, the sentence given by the district court was, quote, not computed through proportionate calculation in relation to the presumptive sentence, unquote. As the district court pointed out here, the district court in sentencing appellant did not give a sentence that was any proportion of the presumptive sentence. That is, the court did not say, I'm giving you the presumptive sentence. I'm giving you the bottom of the box as to the presumptive sentence. I'm giving you some percentage of the presumptive sentence. Instead, the court here based its sentence on aggravating factors, and Kirby is not an aggravating factors case. And the court basically said, based on the nature of your conduct, the severity of your conduct, 240 months is an appropriate sentence for what you did in terms of drug trafficking. The post-conviction court, in looking at what the district court did, basically said, when computing the sentence, quote, there was no formula used to calculate the sentence of 240 months. The entire sentence was about the final number, not about a departing at a certain percentage, unquote. The court thereby concluded the only relief that appellant was entitled to in this case was a modification in the sentencing order to reflect that the presumptive sentence was 65 months, not 86 months. But because the 240-month aggravated sentence was calculated based on the aggravating circumstances of appellant's offense, there was no relief under the DSRA and Kirby other than simply an amendment to reflect that there was a new presumptive sentence. This is basically what the Court of Appeals recognized in Mangan and Robbins, which are the cases that were discussed by the appellant here today.
Ms. Fryer, would you agree with the characterization then, and I'm looking at the judge's order, that there was no resentence, even though the first order suggested setting it for a resentencing? Would you agree with that characterization? There was no resentence, simply clarifying that the original sentence remains the same.
Basically, it's a matter of semantics. There was a resentencing under Kirby in the sense, and this has continued to happen in district court. District courts have referred to, when cases have come back for consideration under Kirby, to refer to it as a resentencing. And regardless of whether there simply is a change in the sentencing order to reflect a new presumptive sentence, or whether there's a determination that the sentence given was the presumptive sentence or a percentage of the presumptive sentence, and therefore a new sentence is given, the courts have basically set the cases for resentencing on the calendar and refer to this as a resentencing. But I think the distinction the court was trying to make here is, yes, there is a resentencing in the sense that we're having consideration of this, we're having a hearing, there'll be a modification or amendment of the sentencing order in some way, but there was no resentencing in the sense that the court was going to resentence on appellant's arguments that he now was entitled to the presumptive sentence because of the inadmissible evidence, because that was NAFLA barred. So the court was trying to make that distinction. Yes, it's set as a resentencing on the calendar. Yes, there's going to be a modification, but I am not going to resentence him with respect to the claims that he is now making, because these claims are NAFLA barred with respect to substantial and compelling aggravating factors and with in regard to inadmissible hearsay. Appellant, in his briefs and here today, basically focuses on the word resentencing because he's gone through cases looking for the idea of a court vacating a sentence, then resentencing. And not in his principal brief, but in his reply brief, he focuses heavily on State versus Prudhomme. And that case simply is not a posit here, doesn't stand for what appellant is trying to use it for in this context. In Prudhomme, the situation was that a district court judge had sentenced appellant for 7 offenses, but actually could only sentence for 3 offenses, one against each of 3 victims. And the court said that the most similar case was State versus Holmes, where for principles of fairness and public policy, the court had said that after there's a new trial, after a case is remanded for a new trial because of a problem with the trial, and the appellate court says, reversing conviction, new trial, there's a new trial, there's a successful re-prosecution, a district court in that situation cannot give a greater sentence than had been given at the time at the first trial, because to do so would be unfair and be against public policy, because it would discourage defendants from exercising their right to an appeal. And the court said, if there's a situation like this where the court gave 7 sentences, only 3 sentences can be given, when it goes back for resentencing, we're going to apply Holmes. We're going to say, this is the same situation as if there is a new trial, a successful re-prosecution. It would not be fair to give a greater sentence on remand after an appeal in this situation. And appellant is now trying to use that to argue that whenever you've got a request for a resentencing under Kirby or in any other situation, you're going to be in the same position as if there had been a successful re-prosecution after a new trial. The whole thing gets reset. That simply does not apply in this situation. In this situation, there was no remand to a district court for a new trial or a new sentencing after an appeal. So the public policy and fairness considerations do not apply in that regard. There's also no issue here of a greater sentence. the state's not asking after Kirby, and certainly post-Otto could not ask the post-conviction court and any other court, and certainly would not ask for a greater sentence. The only argument here is for a by appellant for a sentence reduction based on his argument that he can again bring to the post-conviction court his claims with respect to use of inadmissible hearsay and his argument that his sentence of 240 months just is not proportionate to his offense. So his attempt to use cases like Prudhomme simply doesn't work here. These cases are not a posit to this type of situation.
May I inquire,
because
Ms.
we're
Friars?
Not in that situation.
So would your position be the same if the judge, which apparently the judge did not as I look at the order, actually used the word in that first order, the sentence is vacated, and so we had a resentencing hearing, and then under the resentence did exactly what the judge did. Is your point being that would have no practical effect on the NAFLA bar issue that you've raised?
No, it doesn't. And you know, appellant basically uses the word, focuses on the word vacated, and then cites a case in his principal brief, State versus Soto. But once again, that case simply is not a posit here, as the state explained at some length in its brief. He simply takes a portion of a footnote out of Soto and says, oh, it's important here that the district court said the sentence was vacated. And basically, once again, it's a matter of appellant choosing an apposite case law, and it's simply a matter of the semantics that are sometimes used when judges are calendaring things, whether they say, you know, we're vacating this, we're resentencing it, et cetera. It simply has no practical effect here because the court did not vacate the sentence in the same way, for instance, that an appellate court would vacate or sentence or reverse a conviction. What the court did here, if one looks at the court's order, is use the past tense, saying this is what the court did at the initial sentence. The court calculated the sentence in this way, et cetera. The court is not not vacating the sentence and resentencing. The court is not recalculating the sentence. The court is simply saying this is the appropriate sentence, and so this sentence basically is going to stand. And the words the court used were, this sentence is maintained, this sentence still stands.
But with a modification with respect to the presumptive sentence under the Drug Sentencing Reform Act.
Right, yeah. Basically what the district courts are doing now in this situation under Kirby is changing the sentencing orders to reflect the new presumptive sentence, and then also, as in this situation, looking at the case to see if Kirby does apply here. The district court said no, it does not, because this is a case that involved aggravating circumstances, and this is not a case where I calculated the appropriate sentence based on the presumptive sentence. This is a different situation than in Kirby, and so basically the amelioration doctrine does not apply here as it did in Kirby. This is not that type of case.
Do you agree that the district court certainly had the discretion in consideration of the reduced presumptive sentence to change the sentence had it desired to do so?
The post-conviction court here was the same court as the sentencing court, and certainly then the post-conviction court knew what the sentencing court was considering with respect to calculation. And if the court had determined, if the post-conviction court had determined based on the record and its own recall of events that it had done something different, but here the record doesn't support any suggestion that the district court did anything other than consider the aggravating circumstances and base the sentence on those circumstances, not on some percentage of the presumptive sentence.
Right, but clearly the court had the discretion, had it chosen to reduce the sentence to 230 months, for example.
Right, yeah, the court could have basically said, you know, my calculation was based on these factors in relation to the presumptive sentence, and now I think this is inappropriate. This is an appropriate sentence, but this was not that type of case. The court determined that this didn't fall under Kirby, Mangan, Robbins, any of the cases where the court is discussing a calculation based on the presumptive sentence. But the court certainly could have made that conclusion.
And is that because in the judge's resentencing order, to use the phrase, and you quoted it, there was no formula used to create the 240, the point being it was not X number of months over the top of the box departure.
Right.
And so your point being, if the court had done that, then it might be a more, at least, presumptive or equitable argument, a proportional reduction.
Correct. The other issue that appellate focuses on is the idea that NAFLA does not and cannot apply here. But there is nothing in Kirby, nothing in the law that basically indicates that NAFLA does not apply in this situation. Appellant basically wants a reset. He wants a second bite at the apple, another opportunity to argue that these were factors that should not have been used to compute the sentence. But that issue has already been decided by the Minnesota Supreme Court, which upheld appellant's 240-month sentence. And under NAFLA, there is no redo of that at this point in time. DSRA, Kirby, no case law provides appellant with any way to evade the NAFLA bar. Appellant argues, well, in his principal brief and mentions in his reply brief that, well, this is an ongoing violation, but almost anything can, under the plain error standard, can be referred to then as an ongoing violation, or a defendant could focus on the stigma of having been convicted on continuing our incarceration as an ongoing violation. There simply is no way such an argument is going to provide a way to evade the NAFLA bar. Appellant also argues that his sentence was illegal, but his sentence was authorized at the time it was imposed by the sentencing court, and the Minnesota Supreme Court upheld that sentence. If the Minnesota Supreme Court has upheld a sentence, it certainly cannot be described as illegal. I see I have 8 remaining seconds. If the court has no further questions, the state will rely on its brief.
Very good.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Appellant, if you wish to respond, you may.
I think that opposing counsel is right that Mr. Sanchez is trying to get a second bite at the apple, and under normal circumstances, I don't think you'd be able to do that, but our position is, in this case, that if you have a scenario where the legislature is changing sentencing, changing sentences for crime, saying it's too harsh, and then the Supreme Court decides a case that says even though this happened after you were sentenced, or it's going to apply to you such that you should be resentenced, that's the fortunate situation that allows him to do that, especially when he's getting resentenced to this massive upward departure. We're talking about almost a 4 times upward departure now at this point from the presumptive sentence for him, who had no criminal history score, who walked into court and pled guilty, and he ends up with a 3.69%. And so our position is there's really nothing in the case law that we were able to find during this case that says that these claims, even if you're entitled to be resentenced, that you're not able to make an objection or protect your rights or do any of that. And I think that that's what we're trying to get at with Kirby, where they vacate and remand it for resentencing, is that that's the sort of thing that should then be considered, particularly where we've already had a scenario where we know that if this objection was heard on its merits, I don't think there's any possible way this evidence could be used as it was presented to support this massive upward departure. So that is really the crux of our position, is that if he's going to be resentenced, then why can't he object and protect himself this time, when it's essentially as if they're saying your sentence was based on a criminal history or a guidelines that we don't use anymore that we think was too harsh. And so we would request that the case be remanded for Mr. Sanchez to either get the presumptive sentence or for there to be some fact-finding going on about what his sentence actually should be. Thank you.
Well, thank you to both counsel, both for your arguments today and your briefing, and we will take the matter under advisement and do.